Hey, I'm Peter Mudlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge from WNIJ. And if this is your first time hearing our show, good news. It's a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of this show with us. So please do tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations and your story ideas at teacherslounge@niu.edu. That is teacherslounge@niu.edu. And on our show today is Dr. Jody Vandenberg Daves. Jody is a coach, consultant, mentor, editor, author, and at the end of the day, an educator. She just spent the last 25 years as a professor at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, and she was recently chair of the Department of Race, Gender, and Sexuality Studies there. And like I mentioned, she's also an author of books like Modern Motherhood and American History, which chronicles the history of motherhood in America. And now Jody is teaching, career coaching, mentoring, and has created her own online women's leadership course. She's pretty busy, as you might have guessed, and we talk a lot about what it means to be a mentor and the mentors and teachers she's had in her life. We dive into her book, Modern Motherhood, and a class she taught about the history of motherhood, and so much more. But before we get into that conversation, we have an education story we want to share. How can school boards represent all student voices, from elementary schoolers all the way up through high school? Well, some Northern Illinois school districts bring in student board members to bring issues students are dealing with to the table.
Bathroom soaps and paper towels are not refilled often. Some other concerns that were brought up were like an unbalanced grading system.
Jenna Zimmerman lists off student concerns. She's a student at DeKalb High School heading into her senior year next year, and also the district's second ever student school board member. She's the link between the elected board and nearly 7,000 students from preschool to high school. If you think about it, she represents more people than a lot of mayors. And these concerns she brought to the board, like bathroom access, unfair dress codes, and a test-heavy grading system, are issues you could hear at a lot of different schools, but they don't always get taken seriously enough to make it all the way to the school board. That's Jenna's job.
There's so many students who want to make change, and I just feel like they don't know where to start.
In some ways, she's the voice of DeKalb students, but it's almost impossible to hear from everyone and speak on behalf of everyone in such a large and diverse district. One way she's trying to hear students who want to make change is through speakouts, where they invite students from every school to talk about challenges they're facing. It's how she got the responses she presented, and she's also created a mini board made up of fellow students.
I chose a specific amount of seniors, juniors, sophomores, and freshmen just to make it around an equal amount of people who are actively coming to mini board meetings and sharing their voice.
She had around 20 students last year and hopes to get to 40 next year for a more representative sample. And DeKalb is not the only school district with student school board members. At Rockford Public Schools, they have a student advisory council of about a dozen students from all the district's high schools. Jessica Garcia just graduated from Auburn High School, and she was on the council for the past 2 years. Her school has academies, and the Gifted Academy is always the most represented on the board. But she thought, what about everybody else? What about the students who aren't in every club or every sport?
So I felt like it was really important to elevate student experience that wasn't, you know, high achieving students. You know, there's other students who aren't like that, and they deserve to have their voices represented as well.
And to that point, what about younger students? Student board members are almost always high schoolers. Elementary and middle schoolers often don't have their voices heard or taken seriously. Garcia says one way they're trying to hear from those kids is through a fifth grade mentorship program. And they also applied for a grant to buy books for elementary school students.
How can we get younger students kind of involved, or kind of like what's an issue that a lot of children are facing right now? And that's reading. Reading scores are insanely low.
Back in DeKalb, Zimmerman says she visited both middle schools last year to talk with students and hopes to invite middle and elementary schoolers to mini board meetings next year. The Aurora West School District has had student board representatives for almost 20 years. Ellie Rogowski is a student board member, and she says their district has built some infrastructure that helps students and staff know who their student representatives are. For example, civics classes do an assignment where they research and write down all of their representatives, starting with Congress.
At the bottom of that chart, they had to go and research and find out who their student board representatives are.
Jenna Zimmerman in DeKalb says they brought a lot of important issues to the board this past year, like bringing in new AP classes and bringing back their mandatory study hall. And those discussions will continue into next year, but they did have a few big wins. They helped lead the charge for a new lunch program.
Through the mini board, we were also able to send a few students out to different schools to go taste the different programs that they were going to use next year.
In her last board meeting as a member in Rockford, Jessica Garcia talked about teen dating violence and a new Illinois law that corrects some language about students having the right to a safe learning environment.
Being able to hear that firsthand testimony is really important to bringing about some change.
Conversations like that can be powerful. If schools say they want to hear honest student voices, students say schools have to be prepared to listen to things that might be hard to hear, but do keep giving them the space to share. All right, now it's time for my conversation with teacher, editor, coach, consultant, author, mentor, Dr. Jody Vandenberg-Daves. And in fact, we start off by talking about all the various hats she wears in her career.
I will always be fundamentally an educator and increasingly a kind of mentor. I think those are the two hats I wear the most. And then, well, I should say, and a writer. I mean, educator, mentor, writer. Those are three core things I do, and those really come across in consulting work with organizations, in career coaching, in online courses I teach, and in the fact that I spent, 25 years as a professor at University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, in addition to all the education that got me there. And so I'll always be an educator at heart. I'm just sort of doing it in different spaces and different formats.
I was going to say teacher, mentor, writer. Do you feel like you get to do all three of those things at once sometimes?
In a way, creating content for my courses is writing, but there's something different about writing prose and narrative. I also write poetry, so I really need to be writing. It's just a fundamental piece of who I am. And that is a little bit more separate, quiet space that feeds a different part of me than the extroversion it takes to run an online class or be intensively engaged with someone in career coaching or engage with an organization or do a public speech. Those are all kind of out there things that engage your whole person and your whole social persona. Whereas writing is quiet and meditative and, sometimes frustrating because you're in it all by yourself, but also it's special.
I feel that a lot on my end too, right? Like journalism is so much these conversations, there's a social component to it, but then there's also the alone in the bunker trying to write things. And I often, again, find writing to be both some of the most satisfying work that I do and also the hardest thing that's ever happened to me often.
It's so true. Yeah. And if there's something about it that it lives on in a different tangible way, And I guess I could say too, as an editor, which is another piece of what I do, that really feeds into both writing and teaching. So that's a place where things intersect because I'm really, as a teacher, I feel like a lot of what we're doing, I used to think a lot more in terms of content, which is still vitally important, of course, but I think more about bringing out people's voices and empowering them to have a voice and to own their intellects and to own their values in whatever space they're in. So as an editor, I'm kind of using those writing skills and using the teaching skills.
Yeah, it's interesting. Can you talk a little bit about the work that you're doing right now in terms of the career coaching and the mentorship and that part? Because again, it's a little bit different than the work that you had done for the past, couple decades prior.
Right. Well, there are some threads
sure.
in that I've done some continuing education courses. So adult education, I've kind of had my hands in for a long time. I ran some large federal grants in the 2000s. They were called the Teaching American History Grants. And I actually worked with K-12 teachers on really intensive history education, and so got to work with adult educators that way. I did a few other continuing education courses at UW-La Crosse, but now I'm affiliated with UW-Madison in a couple different divisions of their continuing ed or continuing studies program. So I do teach a course on mentoring, so that's super direct. I teach that's just for anyone in any field about mentoring for inclusivity, engagement, connection, really an extension of the diversity, equity, and inclusion work that I'm very committed to. And then I teach promoting women's leadership in the human services course in the behavioral health division of UW-Madison Continuing Studies. And then I have my own online course that I'm really excited to develop and eventually broaden out to a wider audience. It's called Unlocking Your Leadership Potential. And it's a mostly asynchronous course, so some pre-recorded material, as well as some live sessions. And it's really about naming a lot of leadership skills that women tend to already have, about naming and working around barriers and obstacles, and kind of working together to create more empowering, inclusive workspaces through by empowering yourself as a leader. I'm trying to also equip you with skills to be a good ally and a good, you know, kind of build good teams and lean into leadership styles that are probably already in your wheelhouse, but sometimes don't get recognized and lifted up in our kind of traditional workspaces. And then I also do career coaching, and then I do this developmental editing, usually for academic type publications. And then I'm working on a book. It's tentatively titled Work That Matters, A Guide to Careering for Idealistic Women. And it's based in part on oral histories. I bring some memoir in there. I bring in a lot of research that others have done and sort of synthesize that. And it's kind of a career journey book in the sense that it talks about how to bring your values to build your confidence and empower yourself and others over the course of a career. So it starts out with like establishing your credibility, then moving into mid-career, potentially leadership roles in different ways, managing caregiving and life, and ultimately leaving some kind of legacy in your workplace and in your career. So that's another piece. And it is a lot of hats, and I'm still working on time management in my post-academic world.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that values-driven part of it, because I was curious. I think that one of the ways that I think on your website you talk about it is like helping professionals who want to advance their values-driven career goals. And I was particularly caught by that values-driven part of it because, again, I think so many of us are taught to think of our career goals in terms of, you know, positions and titles and, you know, money, obviously, which is super important, of course, but think about it in terms of advancing your values is something that I feel like is not externalized a lot when people have conversations about what your career goals are.
Yeah, and to me, that's a driver. And I, you know, I recently did a leadership kind of seminar with a colleague, and one of the participants said something that sort of emerged for her out of our little seminar, which is that when I'm working in my values, there's less friction. There's more, you know, there's just more opportunity to lead and to have your voice. And so part of that for me is lifting up different kinds of leadership, is actually valuing different ways that we can lead. It's not all about position or a formal role. I bring that up because you kind of referenced that. So it's, you know, we can be thought leaders. We can be advocacy leaders. We can be leaders on specific kinds of projects. We can be kind of informal leaders by being team builders. Women often do the feminist term is emotional labor in the workplace. That is a kind of leadership that kind of can lift up a lot of people. It can also be sometimes undervalued. Again, that's part of why I talk about this, is to embrace the things that we might already bringing to the workplace and see how we can leverage them towards really pro-social values in the workplace.
Well, it's interesting too that you have it kind of from both ends now, where you are both teaching classes about and courses about mentorship and about leadership, and then doing the mentorship and doing the leadership work as at the same time too.
Yeah, and you know, towards the end of my career in the academic world, that was so much a focus. Actually my last year at University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, I did not teach in the classroom. I really just decided that I wanted to to really focus on being a mentor and a department leader, because I was chair of the department, and to help nurture that next generation of academic leaders, and, you know, and help them grow. And it was really nice to do that kind of focused work, because ultimately it is, you know, you're working within systems, and the systems are very imperfect, and you can't get for your department or unit everything you want. You can't always change that system, hard as I've tried, but you can be transparent and empowering and bring out people's strengths. And that's hopefully the legacy we can leave in our institutions as educators, even when we feel like we're tilting at windmills around some of the bigger structural issues. It's that value of how you treat and empower people, how you see their genius and try to bring it out.
Yeah. I am really fascinated about mentorship, and I was thinking about it within the context of what my show is, and kind of the conceit and like the pitch that I often throw out about the show is that Teacher's Lounge is based on this really simple idea that everyone has had an educator who inspired them or helped them become the person they are today. And right, educator in a really broad umbrella of, you know, whatever, that's a traditional classroom teacher, coach, anything else. But I was thinking about how like having a teacher in your life who inspired you isn't exactly the same thing as having a mentor, right? Like those are two distinct things. You can have a teacher who, you know, teaches something that just like catches you and you find to be really fascinating and that you take with you long after. But that's not necessarily an active mentorship. And so I was kind of curious to ask about like what qualities specific, not just to an educator, but to a mentor, what qualities make up a strong active mentor?
I'm sure I won't get them all in the first pass, but yeah. The one that comes up most often is listening and holding space for people and not trying to make a mini me and not making mentoring an egotistical project, but being really invested in the whole person. And how do you cultivate that investment? That's partly, again, through listening and relationship building. It's really not like so many other things related to leadership. I like to move away from the transactional kind of language around it, because it really is more relationship building and trust building. And I think particularly with mentorship, when we're trying to be mentors to and learn from and be humble with people whose identities are different from ours, it's all the more important to build trust, to acknowledge that there are all kinds of things that you don't know, that mentoring is kind of a two-way street, but that and you have to be willing to learn. And that doesn't mean that person always has to be your teacher, but when you find things that you don't know about it, that are coming up, it's your responsibility to go try to learn a little bit about that to be a better mentor. And then I think, you know, it depends on your role, but I talk about this a lot in the mentoring class. If you're a supervisor in particular, I think that there's really an advocacy role in mentoring that's important, letting people know that not only are you listening, but you're trying to use the resources you have institutionally, the platform you have institutionally, to be an advocate for the people that you want to see grow and flourish and bring out their talents.
Yeah, I was curious because, you know, when we ask people about being teachers and kind of what led them to pursuing the profession, a lot of times we hear people say that, like, you know, they became a teacher because they had a teacher when they were young, or, you know, at some point in their experience who they're like, I want to be just like them. Or sometimes we have the opposite, which is that, like, I want to be the person that I didn't have. And I was curious, when it comes to like your interest in like mentorship and leadership, do you feel like you've had some great mentors throughout your life? Or is there part of it where you're like, I wish I had that person, I want to be that person for someone else? Maybe it's a mixture of the two.
It's kind of a mixture of the two. And because you you referenced this in your email, I kind of did some thinking about the different ways in which I was mentored.
Yeah.
I feel like most of those relationships were sort of short term, most of them. And that in my generation, we didn't talk a lot about mentoring. I was a first generation college student. I didn't know that mentoring and networking were things. Yeah. I didn't I didn't know that. And so I don't feel like I sought out mentoring in the way that some, I think, younger people do. And I've also learned, you know, partly through my book research that people's people can experience mentoring in very small but impactful ways. You know, somebody can say one thing to you and it can be pivotal to you in terms of a mentoring moment, yeah. I guess you could say. You know, I think that when I was young, part of the teacher mentor experience for me was people who showed me a bigger world. You know, my French teacher in high school, my history teachers, I mean, my PhDs in history, because it was the historians who really opened up the world for me. They showed me that I was part of a living history moment, that my parents' generation were, that the generations that went before were part of living history. And they also articulated the largeness and complexity of the world really, really well. So they were, I mean, my most inspiring educators were my college professors, particularly some historians. I think of Norm Rosenberg, Peter Ratcliffe, at McAllister College, where I got my undergraduate degree. And they also showed some of the connections between activism and education, solidarity and education, popular culture and education. And then I learned about a lot about class and race and gender from those professors. Going into graduate school, I felt like I got mentored a bit, like actually mentored by a historian of China. That was my field was U.S. history. But this woman, Ann Waltner, she was a historian of China. And I took a class or two from her just because I was interested in the big wide world and I wanted to study a culture that I really didn't know much about. And she, of all people, said some of the things that I remember, you know, helped me see my own confidence, helped me, just felt like she was investing in me.
Right.
So those are some early mentors. And also a woman who I did not take classes with at McAllister, but who I kind of knew because she was in the history department and she's just a gem. Her name is Emily Rosenberg, and she's was at that time at least a well-known author in her own right. Still is. Her book's still out there. But she actually encouraged me to basically apply for a really prestigious award from the Organization of American Historians for the best graduate student paper in the field of U.S. history, which is a vast field. And I thought, me? Why me? I have, you know, this is like the best in any field. That could be anything in the whole field of U.S. history. And, you know, I just said, okay, you told me I should apply. You tapped me on the shoulder. I did. And I won that award. Now, there were 28 applicants. So that's also interesting because, you know, there could have been thousands. So how many people didn't have that person tapping them on the shoulder? You know, and I remember to this day that there were 28 applicants, right?
Right, yeah.
But how many people didn't have that person who said, I'll bet you could do this, you know? And it was actually not my graduate professor for whom I'd written the paper, but my undergraduate professor who was still in touch with me and said, hey, you should think about this. So she was nurturing me as a future academic, you know, long after several years at least after I left my undergrad. And she had never even had me in the classroom.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So those are a few. I could go on if you want me to.
No.
Okay. Because I did take a few notes, yeah, thinking about this. So in graduate school, yeah, I felt like I had some mentoring from this historian of China. I did not feel like I had a ton of mentoring beyond that in some of the spaces where you might expect it from professors. I felt like there was a lot of busyness and I felt like I was a little bit in between the cracks. But I really did get a lot of good peer mentoring. And we were kind of a cohesive group of graduate students. And I had a friend who, you know, unlike me, was not first generation college, you know, had come from a longer line of people with advanced degrees and things like that. And I remember her really helping me with my perfectionism. And I think that perfectionism is partly born from these systems not being comprehensible to people who are first generation college. Also being a woman contributed. Anyway, this friend of mine, remember, she said, you know, Jody, no one thing you do is going to ruin it for you.
I take that as a challenge.
I guess I did take it as a challenge. Mostly I took it as a reassurance, like, really? really, I don't have to be perfect at everything I do. So mentors, you know, can really be peers too. And then I think about like my fellow graduate students also like modeling for me ways to be an activist. I had seen that at McAllister, but I hadn't participated as much. So in graduate school, I kind of joined forces with some of my fellow graduate students, and we advocated for a graduate student union. We worked really hard on it. I was not one of the people that worked the hardest. There were other people who really gave up time to degree progress to do that. And we didn't win, but we learned a lot in the process. And also, I was part of a group of women historians called Women with a Past that just sort of was a, you know, kind of empowerment group for those of us in that space. And those are things that, you know, you can learn maybe in school with your peers, and then they become part of how you help create spaces for people as you move into your professional life. And then I think about, you know, that was about challenging systems. And as I got into my work in higher education, challenging systems, creating new spaces for people, empowering spaces. There were a lot of people showing me how to do that as well. And so I had a number of mentors, some of whom were younger than me, not all of whom were professors. You know, there's, I think, of Amanda Goodenough, who worked at University of Wisconsin-La Crosse for a long time, was such a leader on social justice issues. Sarah Doken Morgan, who is a friend and colleague of mine, just modeling some wonderful ways to speak up and speak out. And Sandy Krajewski, who was, older than me, actual mentor over a number of years. And in some ways identified her as the first sort of long-term-ish mentor I ever had, because she was around for a long time. She really was instrumental in solidifying what became the Women's Studies and later Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department that I would eventually chair myself. And she was someone who just was always in my corner, always, how can I support you in your career? And, you know, again, I wish I'd had more of that and more of that long term, but that's, I'm trying to be the person that I needed more as I get older. And then I think about people who also helped show me the way to break down some of the arbitrary barriers. That could be between the sort of academic part of the college world and the social support for students part of the college world, but also the academic space and the community space. So I learned from leaders in my institution, like Thomas Harris in Multicultural Student Services, who was everywhere in the community and helped link me up to the Greater La Crosse Area Diversity Council, nonprofit that I ended up being the executive director of for several years while I was a professor. Andrea Hansen, who directs the self-sufficiency program out of our department at University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, that's now called Race, Gender, and Sexuality Studies. Lots of words in our titles. But anyway,
say, yeah.
Andrea was also one of those people who just we're going to be in the community. You know, we're going to be linking ourselves to the community, and this all helped me see that really a university or a K-12 school, they're community resources. And I think they're really visionary thinkers. Break down those barriers and help people see how not only can they access, say, higher education, but higher education can give back to them in their community. And also higher education, people in higher education can be learners, not just teachers, you know, can go out and learn from communities and partner with communities. So I do feel like I appreciate the, you know, you helping me think about this question, because there's so many people along the way that helped me see what can I be as an educator? Who can I be as an educator? And, you know, how can I be, I guess, contributing to social justice and community building and student empowerment? And then, you know, writing along the way, I definitely saw people who managed to do research and writing and be teachers, but I feel like I was often pretty self-directed in that regard. Just that's maybe partly just having a supportive spouse who supported everything I did. But also, I remember him telling me once, "You're a writer. You've just got to be writing," and that helped me sort of claim that.
Yeah, it's really nice to have other people be able to like stamp that for you every once in a while and be like, yeah, yes, I am. Yes, thank you.
yeah, exactly.
I was thinking through the context of, you know, you've recently, I think it was last summer that you left University of Wisconsin La Crosse. So like at a bit of a career shift point for you, I was like, it seems like a great time to have a mentor in your life. But then I think about like, at least again, this is just my perspective and maybe this isn't exactly true, but like, it seems like the further you get into your, like the deeper that you get into your career, the less likely it seems they would be to have someone in your life that you think of as like a mentor or think of that way.
Yeah, I think especially if we think of mentoring traditionally as someone who's further along a prescribed path and older than you. So again, I didn't name here every mentor I've had, including so many wonderful peer mentors at University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. But yeah, that's true. And in fact, that's one of the things as I'm preparing to write that last part of this book project, which is, you know, it's about that last part is kind of about legacies and that. Often corresponds with being older, you know, like being older than 50, let's say. And yeah, I mean, that's one thing that women, the women in my interview group who are older than 50, you know, some of them have said, like, you don't have as many mentors anymore. You don't look forward to see, you know, what am I doing next necessarily by looking at a particular person and how they're doing it. So yeah, I think that one of the ways that we need to do better with mentoring in our workspaces is that mentoring is not just for young people. Mentoring is for helping people grow and flourish through their whole career, and also valuing the wisdom of older people. We have a little bit of a throwaway culture in general in the United States.
Yeah.
And the kind of like, what's hot and new and relevant. And as I look a little bit at the issues and concerns of older workers, it's, you know, is there still space for me to use my voice? Are people using me as a resource? Can I move, you know, and I thought I've, you know, been in this space myself a little bit of like, how can I be a little bit more of a consultant and do perhaps a little bit less heavy lifting and proving myself? You know, you shouldn't really have to do that ideally. At a certain point, it's like, do I still have to keep doing this? And how do we really honor that, I think, for older workers and make sure that there are sort of at least mentoring circles or mentoring spaces where people can talk about these different challenges that may come up at different stages of career? But as you said about career shifts, and you know, I think in every shift in a career, and I've really had a lot, despite being 25 years in one place, I did a lot of different things in those 25 years, plus some things before that. But I think that we always need to connect with some people who are in somewhat similar spaces.
I was curious to ask you, since you've had the shift over the last year or so, and obviously, you know, you're working with, there's the social component of what you do is still very much there, even if it's not within a traditional classroom structure as much. I was curious, do you feel like it scratches the same itch as traditional classroom teacher? Is it satisfying in a slightly different way, or how have you found it over the past year?
I think I'm still learning.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great question. There's something a little bit, the word I am finding right now is anticlimactic about signing off of a Zoom session with anyone. And you're not sure what happened. You know, you're not sure. It's harder to tell because you're not coming back day after, or, you know, week after week to meet and to explore the stuff together. On the other hand, I think I was ready to be done with the structure of undergraduate classrooms and with the grading and with just kind of being in the system. I like the feeling that, you know, different things can happen and we can continue these relationships through coaching or other kinds of projects outside of, say, a class I teach for UW-Madison continuing studies. So I do like that. But at the same time, yeah, I think I would like to move in the future into more in-person opportunities. I think there's a lot of us are still dealing with the legacy of COVID where we like are excited about the fact that you can do all this great stuff on Zoom and you can build some connections across time and space. But not too long ago, I presented for the YWCA Empowerment Summit in La Crosse here, and it felt so great to be in front of a live audience, and it felt really great to be able to walk out of the room with people and have those kind of follow-up conversations. So yeah, I'm still on a learning curve with how to kind of find that balance for myself of the opportunities of online learning, but the need for, you know, real face-to-face human connection.
Yeah, I've had so many conversations via Zoom over the past 4 years, and it's still like, especially when you have a conversation that you find to be very fulfilling or really exciting, that you click off, you log off it, and then you're just kind of buzzing, you're just kind of pacing around the apartment, you're like, I don't even know what to do with all this energy.
Exactly. Yes. That's kind of how it is. So, I mean, maybe it's partly finding creative follow-ups, you know, the leadership retreat that my colleague, Dr. Keely Reese, and I ran, we had scheduled a follow-up hour to meet with those folks again and just kind of see what's clicking, what's still on your mind, and trying to meet professionals where they are too, because professionals are not going to do a 14-week class for, that's not what they're going to do. So how do you find those ways to meet people that way?
We talked a little bit about, this book that you're working on now. This is not the first book that you've written, though. In fact, you mentioned that you've written a book of poetry, and you also wrote Modern Motherhood, which is about, was it 2014 that it got published?
Yes, the 10-year anniversary right now.
Special edition paperback must be coming out, you know what I mean? That's the 10-year anniversary edition. Yes.
I wish. It's an academic press, so I think they're scraping nickels off the floor. That's how academic presses are. But Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Modern Motherhood, I taught a History of Motherhood course for many years before I undertook that project. And then it took about 6 years of intensive research and writing and a sabbatical. And I took a year of part-time work to finish that book. I had another year where I got some support for part-time from my department chair. It took a long time to write that book, but it's been incredibly rewarding, actually, in part because with the pandemic, there's been a real revived interest in all these topics. And I, for a while there, was getting contacted by journalists like every month or two for a story or an interview. And so it has been a gift that has kept on giving. I felt like it was probably my magnum opus as far as academic writing, because the next book is not quite as, hardcore academic. I mean, this Modern Motherhood is readable to non-academic audiences. I've had a lot of people tell me that, but it's still, we dot all the I's and cross all the T's, and it's very much a peer-reviewed academic press book. But yeah, that was super rewarding to write and also exhausting. And so, of course, the next thing I needed to do was self-publish some poetry.
Did that feel like it was like a detox from after that whole 6-year process?
It ended up not being until 5 years later, but when I think about it, looking back, I was exhausted from the heavy labor of scholarship, of that level of intense scholarship. And so I had been writing these poems for many years, and I kind of didn't know what I had. And then I was reading them aloud one day to my spouse, and he said, "You kind of got a memoir in poems." And before I knew it, I decided, well, that would be really fun to self-publish a book of poetry. And then, this other book is coming up sort of behind that. And I think there's probably a little bit of a rhythm to the very intense nonfiction and the much more short writing of poetry, short and emotional.
Yeah. Can you talk a little, I wanted to ask you both about kind of what brought you to the book and why you wanted to write it and what that looks like. But first, I do want to dive a little bit into the process of that type of, research heavy, like you said, like academic work. Because I think about my perspective as a journalist, right? Like there are times where I'm working on what I find to be like very heavily researched, projects where it might end up being, 2 or 3 stories. So at the end of the day, it might end up being like, 12 minutes worth of audio or something like that. Like, some like 2,000 words. You're writing something that is much longer. You're writing something that's, over 300 pages. And I was curious about kind of just like what that process looks like in terms of, like you said, you spent 6 years, you're, you know, diving into primary sources, talking to people. Like, can you get people just who aren't familiar with what that kind of, you know, like you said, like very, you know, heavily researched nonfiction work, kind of what that looked like for you?
Well, it really is different. I need to differentiate a little bit some of the scholarship I did before that as well, because historians are trained to look at primary sources, as you said, material written at the time. And so I had a number of journal, you know, academic journal articles I published using primary sources. But this book used a little bit of primary sources, but it's actually a synthesis. It was the first synthesis of the scholarship on like what we know in the field of the history of motherhood ever. And I say, and part of the reason I always emphasize that is, isn't that amazing? Like, this is actually the job we told women that they should always be doing, every single woman, was that's what she's supposed to do. And we have some limitations in how we've written history about that. In fact, you know, at the time, at least, and I can't say this is true at this present moment, someone would have to Google it, but at the time I was writing it, there were no national histories of motherhood, like a synthesis, you know, like from the beginning of the nation to the present moment. And so what I did is I pulled together the scholarship that was available and did a synthesis. So it's a different kind of work than what we often call a monograph based on primary sources.
Yeah.
Again, I did include some, but a lot of the work was synthesizing and trying to accurately represent the work of other scholars and kind of bring an interpretive structure to that. And just figuring out the structure was a little overwhelming. At one point I thought, I'm going to do this thematically. That seems like the most approachable way. Different kinds of themes in mothers' lives and the public policy around motherhood and how we talk about mothers, cultural stuff. I'll do that. And I approached an editor about it, actually at Harvard University Press. And she was interested enough to talk to me, but she said, I don't understand why you're doing it thematically. How do you teach it to your students? And I said, oh, chronologically. And she said, we'll do that. And it was kind of basic and simple. And then she decided to pass on the book. But what she said was, it's just not where my energy is, but I think you should go to the other, you know, you should go to Princeton, you should go to Yale. And, I wound up at Rutgers, which is a great press, and I'm happy to have published there. But it was an interesting moment where, you know, just finding the structure of the book can be actually really one of the hardest things. And it's been one of the hardest things in the book I'm writing now as well. But ultimately, I did kind of use the fact that I'd been teaching this class for years. I had to pack a bunch of information into particular class periods. And that gave me a way to think about things. And I did have one thematic chapter that I really loved, which is about mothers' resourcefulness and resilience. And that was a little bit spanned a little broader period of time and was kind of thematic and was part of the point I was trying to make in the book, which is that we've asked every woman to do this job. Some may decide not to do it, but we've sort of said as a culture, this is your job. But we have not given them the resources to do it. We have a very unfamily friendly society. You know, so many structures around capitalism and sexism and racism and all those kinds of things make mothering a really challenging job. And so a lot of it is about scraping up those resources and being resilient and being strategic. And so that was a really fun way to get into the material and on my own terms, an example of, I wasn't just sort of going, here's what we know from this period to this period, but it was also an interpretive process. And that's why it took 6 years. So.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like the kind of impetus for writing it was, you know, you had taught this class for a while, and that it sounds like it was just that you saw this gap, that this synthesis of this history just didn't exist in one cohesive place, and that you wanted to kind of fill that.
That's right. I mean, and the initial impetus for that was my firstborn child becoming a mother. Not surprisingly, I have three children. But yeah, so realizing that experience needed to be historicized, and that was the seed for the class, which was not taught in too many places at the time. Then the seed for the book was exactly what you said. And I think that's true of most books. We often write the books we know we want to read, and we know we want to be out in the world, and that they're missing. So somebody's got to write them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it really is, like you said, this is a history of motherhood through the context of U.S. history, right? Like, and it is, like, again, like, we are starting back in the 1700s in the 18th century, and there's some, you know, really fascinating stuff, too, about, like, I think it's in the first chapter, like, you start off with these really interesting things about how, like, the ideas about mothers as unique moral guardians only emerged at the time of the American Revolution, and, like, getting back to what those ideas of motherhood were, like, you know, in, like, pre-colonial Europe and stuff. It's very, very fascinating stuff.
Oh, thanks. I love to think about it. I still love to talk about it.
You know, I wanted to also, I think we talked about it just a little bit, but we always like to talk about, like, what your educator or teacher origin story was. I was curious what it looked like for you. Is teaching something that you wanted to do since you were young, or is it something that came to you a little bit later on?
Well, I am an oldest child, so I don't know. My brothers might have something to say about me.
Yeah.
In that respect. But I think of high school when I started doing a little bit of tutoring, and I remember really enjoying that, really just finding that a sweet connection and a cool way to engage with learning and with people. And, you know, that empowerment piece and that relationship piece that was there in high school. And then, as I said, I had professors who kind of modeled what it could look like to make the world, to show the enormity and complexity of the world, and to teach critical thinking, and to use education as a tool of social justice to really challenge systems and create critical thinkers. So that, I would say, was college. Although another piece for me is that, As I said, I was the first generation in my family to go to college. My parents really valued education and supported me so much. My mom did go to for a two-year degree, but for a four-year degree, I was the first in my family to do that. And I think part of what that meant is that I wasn't exposed to a lot of different kinds of professions. And in my generation, we didn't do a lot of internships and that kind of thing. And so, in some ways, teaching, these are the professionals, a certain kind of professionals that I admired and knew. My mom was a realtor, so also a professional, a more entrepreneurial professional. But I think within the sort of employer-based professional world, I didn't know a lot of other options. And I was always told I was good at school, I was a good student. And then I knew that I loved learning, and that tutoring experience had really taught me something. So I thought, well, I'll be a K-12 educator, because that was something that seemed accessible and approachable to me. And I actually did a bunch of the courses as an undergrad to get my social studies certification, because I fell in love with history pretty quickly. But I got really discouraged by how many requirements there were for that weren't rewarding as classes in and of themselves. And I just wanted to learn. I wanted to take more actual social studies classes content. And it was also a professor who was influential. I mentioned Norm Rosenberg, a historian, and he said, you know, I'd love to see you in the classroom with my kids, someone like you, but I know also that you really have what it takes to go get your PhD if that's what you want to do. And then I got applied for and received a Truman Scholarship, which is a public service scholarship that's been around for decades. And it's for people going into public service careers. And by this time, I think I was set on trying to get the PhD, but my application was about building bridges between higher education and K-12, which I really did end up doing, especially when I was directing federal grants for history education. So I did just go and pursue that PhD, and always kind of wanted to be at a teaching institution, though, because I wanted to be kind of turning on the light bulbs for young people. The further along I got in being a teacher, the more I saw my work, as I kind of mentioned earlier, less about, let's make sure they have all this important content and they know all this history. And it became more about nurturing and learning from young people and developing relationships with them and trying to empower them to feel like they could take up space in the world, you know, and do the things they long to do. And I think teaching at a public university where, a lot of students don't feel maybe quite as entitled to dream big. And I think that was part of why I always wanted to be also at a public institution to help, help students dream that way, I guess.
Yeah. Well, Jody, I don't have too many more questions for you, but again, I want to thank you for taking so much time out of your day to have this conversation. I have to ask, and again, you spent years as a professor in women's studies. You were the chair of the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department. And I was curious what, you know, obviously over the past couple of years, when we're talking about nationally, you've seen politicians in different states try to, you know, target and sometimes eliminate programs like, you know, women's studies and gender studies programs and things like that. And as someone who's, you know, obviously was until just a couple months ago teaching in there, being a department head in those, you know, in that space, I was curious kind of how you've been feeling over these past couple of years as you've seen that kind of happen at different places across the country.
Oh, profoundly discouraged. I mean, really profoundly discouraged on the one hand. On the other hand, I guess maybe this is a historian in me and the person who just is always trying to reach across generations. There are people who are willing to continue to take on that fight and adapt and be resilient. And they are, you know, doing their work in universities and in K-12. And I just think as a society, we need to keep figuring out how to empower them and lift up their work so that they can keep fighting those fights, because those are very deliberate, targeted attacks. And I know that they've been, I mean, attacking higher education in general, and particularly public higher education. I'm in Wisconsin. I've seen that go on. And I was very involved in protesting Scott Walker's initiatives that have so much reshaped the landscape for higher ed, as well as, of course, K-12. You know, I talk to current teachers in schools whose compensation package has been just eviscerated by the changes to healthcare and all the policies that Walker brought in. So this is a very it's a longstanding thing, but so is the fight. You know, having been involved in different thing, union organizing, both as a grad student and then as a professor, and we just keep fighting, you know, but I think I am leaving some of that direct fight to a younger generation in some ways and trying to support them.
I did see there was some recent report from the National Women's Studies Association about how, despite that student interest in those programs and those classes is actually growing. So it seems like it's kind of, maybe some of that national attention has also resulted in a growing interest in people wanting to seek out those courses.
I'm glad you brought that up. That is so true. I think that is very much the encouraging part, is that you can't really quash ideas. And this is a moment of resurgence of feminist, anti-racist activism, LGBTQ+ activism, and you can't really stop it, of union activism. And so young people are finding their own ways into that material through the internet, even if they're not exposed to it in schools. And very often when I teach the intro to race, gender, and sexuality studies, I would ask students if they'd ever been exposed to some of this content, particularly around gender, in their schools, and they usually hadn't. But I know more and more of them are getting exposed in their own ways, not always in ways that are, you know, it's not always constructive or accurate.
Right.
It's the internet.
Yeah.
But there's some, they're showing up. There's more students showing up going, I'm ready to figure out how to challenge this. And that's where a lot of hope lies too.
Yeah. We always like to end on a couple questions, which are like, what's something that you wish more people knew? I'll do one that's specific to women's studies and one that's just specific to education in general to end us off. So is there something about women's studies that you just think is more important than people might realize, who, again, come into those classes without a lot of prior knowledge or without a lot of prior education in it?
History has so often been taught as the, not just the deeds of great men, but of access, as a story of people trying to access the public world and get the right to vote and, you know, work in the similar jobs that men work in and get those wages and get the opportunities for leadership. And that's vitally important. But women are, patriarchal cultures have so long defined women by their bodies and their private roles. And so part of the reason I did so much teaching and research on the history of motherhood, is that the history of our lives and our relationships with our families, with the role of motherhood, and with, for women, just living in bodies that have been defined as appropriate for other people to have surveillance over or to consider property. I mean, just the fact that the idea that women should have some autonomy over their bodies, particularly sexually, is really pretty new historically. And I think just knowing that alone, that that's a right we need to really, really preserve, is the right to autonomy over our bodies, sexually and reproductively. And that people fought really hard for that. In addition to fighting for, you know, fair wages and the Civil Rights Act and all these other things, there's those things around our bodies and also our not just our rights, but sort of when anyone becomes a parent, I mean, accessing the resources needed to do that job, you know, what does that job look like in the day to day? And what does our society need to do to support mothers and all parents? Those are things that, like, trying to reimagine a society that values caregiving is, I think, a really key piece of what women's studies has to offer.
Is there something about education you wish more people knew?
I think that we, as you say, education is incredibly broad, and we need to honor our teachers in whatever form they come. And our teachers can be people we learn from in books, they can be our parents, and they can be those people in our workplaces, and they can be our teachers in our classrooms. But as far as professional educators, it's a labor of love. These are such honorable professions, and it's been very emotionally challenging to see that work devalued or diminished or politicized in ways that are harmful to educators and to kids. And I just think we all need to find ways to lift up our educators, whether that's supporting our public education funds in our communities, giving shout outs to our educators, advocating for public policy to invest in our educators through partly their salaries and their compensation packages, because educators are really the people in some ways in charge for caring for all our kids in our society. And that is, there are kids, there are future, whether it's, you know, little kindergartners or college students, we need to invest in the people who are investing in our kids and to show our kids the value of learning and growing minds and growing people.
That was Dr. Jody Vandenberg-Daves, former professor at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, author of books like Modern Motherhood and American History, career coach and consultant. And you can find more information about her work over at her website, which is jodyvandenberg-daves.com. Thank you so much to everyone for listening to Teacher's Lounge. And as always, feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests like Jody. Send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And please continue to send your story ideas so we can keep bringing you the best education coverage possible. Wherever you're hearing the show, please do subscribe, leave us a rating, or share so we can get even more perspectives on the show. You can subscribe to the Teacher's Lounge newsletter over at WNIJ.org. A big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode. And I have been your host, Peter Mudlin, and we'll be back with even more Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.